against Owens is our final case of the morning. Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, I tried this case, and I have to admit that the government is correct in its first point. I did not make a motion at the close of evidence. I did not renew my Rule 29 motion in the heat of battle, and I should have. But that being said, Judge, I think there is a combination of circumstances here with respect to Mr. Owens, which I think deserves a great deal of attention. Everybody else who was involved in this case, who pled guilty or who testified, reaped large amounts of money. Only Mr. Owens. Now, the government argued that Mr. Owens went cheaply, but there are other reasons why Mr. Owens went cheaply. Mr. Owens did not know what's going on, and the evidence did not show that he knew what was going on.
He didn't know that there were two sales and that there was a subsequent sale for which he was giving an appraisal?
No, Your Honor. And there was no evidence that he knew those things that you have just asked about in particular in your question. There is no evidence that he knew specifically about double sales. There is one bit of testimony that he admitted to an agent that he knew there were flip sales going on. Now, flip sales, and there is other testimony that flip sales aren't always illegal. Many people buy properties and then resell them almost on the same day for investment purposes. The fact that he admitted that he knew there were flip sales is not an admission, and it's not tantamount to an admission that he knew that there was an illegal flip sale going on. What he didn't know as well, Your Honor, he didn't know that there were false documents submitted in all of these transactions, some 80 transactions. Now, if Mr. Owens participated, it is in the government's evidence, and virtually at 10 only, and was paid approximately $8,000. And there's some muddle as to what he actually did make on it. But I would point out that Ms. Nguyen, who was the other appraiser, who did all of the other appraisals, was paid $5,000 per appraisal.
So she knew what was going on.
She had to have known what was going on. She was reaping the money.
That's why she charged so much.
Yes. And Ms. Smith, who orchestrated and engineered the false documents and presided with the lawyer over the closings, made $5,000 to $10,000 per closing. And that was because no one intended ever to send a penny back to the lender. And from the lender, a great deal of money came. Now, the strongest point against my client with respect to this is the disparity in his appraisals and the original purchase price. And in those disparities, he did a very poor job, a very bad job. But we submit that it did not amount to knowledge of a scheme to defraud anybody. Taking these facts in combination with the fact that the government put on a witness, an expert, Mr. Miasso, who we believe violated 704B in that Mr. Miasso's testimony came very close to and over the line with respect to testimony about the intent of the defendant. It did that all through, but it did it in very specific language when Mr. Powers, with great flourish, asked Mr. Miasso, could a legitimate appraiser have come to the conclusion of $183,000 in a particular appraisal? We objected to that. We objected to that because there you had a specific act by the government attorney imputing in his question to the defendant and eliciting from the expert's opinion that the intent was to defraud on the part of Mr. Owens.
Why? Because he said legitimate?
Yes.
What adjective should he have used?
Well, he could have simply asked the expert whether or not a particular appraisal that the expert arrived at, he thought, had any basis in fact. And whether, but he, the government attorney, in asking the question, made it personal. He asked about, could any legitimate appraiser, could, in other words, Mr. Owens, be legitimate? The implication is that he was illegitimate all the time, and that was an imputation of personal knowledge to Mr. Owens, when he should have been confined. The expert should have been confined to testifying with respect to why he thought particular appraisals themselves did not meet the standards. And there were plenty of standards talked about in this trial. Standards with respect to the national and state standards and licensing standards and what an appraiser does and how they disagree. If he kept his testimony there, that would have been fine for an expert.
Counsel, I'm not sure why, in your view, Rule 704B is applicable. The introductory clause to 704B says it applies to an expert witness, quote, testifying with respect to the mental state or condition of the defendant, close quote. And that sounds like a description of psychologists, psychiatrists, and the like. And it's certainly not the expertise of this witness.
And I did the genesis of that rule indeed was to curb psychologists.
The genesis of that rule was the attempted assassination of President Reagan. We're
right.
We're well aware.
Yes, and
but I'm trying to figure out whether that language is logically read or has ever been read to cover more than mental state experts.
Well, I don't see why it cannot be based on the words of the rule, Judge.
This expert was not an expert with respect to mental state or condition, was he?
Well, mental state with respect to intent is an intent of mental state.
No. Look, there are two parts of the rule. The first part of 704B states effectively who it applies to. And the second part says what he can say. So it's clear that a psychiatrist, that is an expert on mental state or condition, cannot testify on the ultimate issue. It's not at all clear that an accountant, for example, can't testify with respect to his view of the mental state of the person filling out the report on the ground that no person who had, you know, that only a person with intent to defraud could have put down these issues. May not be important here. Maybe it's more important in Enron or something like that. But are there any cases applying Rule 704B to somebody who is not an expert with respect to mental state or condition?
And excluding it? No, not that I know of, Judge. Excluding it. In the Brumley and the Brown case, which I quote, I believe it came up with respect to testifying as to the expertise of a witness with respect to whether or not there was an intent to distribute cocaine based on all of the circumstances of the drug dealer's business, so to speak, his possession of a gun, the amount of drugs he had, the presence of a scale, and all that business. And it was from those cases that we indicated, Judge, that we believe that 704B could apply. The two cases I cite in my brief, Brumley and Brown. I have no further answer to that, Judge.
Okay. Well, if there's not much out there, there's not much out there.
Thank you, Judge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Penn.
May it please the Court, to file on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, I'd like to put the issue of the testimony regarding Mr. Miazzo into perspective. With respect to his testimony that the appraisal reports were misleading and fraudulent, in the context of his testimony, it's clear that testimony had no outcome, no bearing on the outcome of this trial. Now, there was no objection below, and certainly no objection before this court with respect to Mr. Miazzo's expertise in the area of appraisal. And at trial, he testified at length regarding the inadequacies and the deficiencies of Mr. Owens' appraisal report. And the testimony in what Mr. Miasto testified to, he set forth his bases, he set forth the various industry standards, and in the end, his testimony essentially was that the reports bear no likeness at all to what appraisals are supposed to look like. The appraisal that Mr. Owens performed contained none of the essential information that an appraisal should contain. For example, Mr. Miasto testified about the lack of the multiple listing service information, which is the database that real estate appraisers and real estate agents use to determine what houses are on the market, what the asking price for those houses are, what the how long the house has been on the market, and other pertinent information. Mr. Owens never included any of that information in his appraisals. Basic things like the MLS asking price, which of course goes to the lender, and because that information was not included, the lender doesn't know what the value of the home is.
Counsel, may I ask you the same question that I was asking Mr. Clark, which is what is the scope of Rule 704B? Does it apply to people whose expertise is not expertise, quote, with respect to the mental state or condition of a defendant, close quote?
Your Honor, I believe that 704B, there are cases in the Seventh Circuit and other circuits that have applied 704B beyond psychiatric testimony.
Well, of course. It would include any expert with respect to a mental state or condition.
Yes, Your Honor.
But are there cases that have applied it to accountants or the like?
The Windfelder case, which we cited in our brief, Your Honor, which is a Seventh Circuit case, the site being 790 F2nd 576, that's a Seventh Circuit 1986 case.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of Fifth Circuit cases, the Agarwal case, as well as the Sheriff's case out of the Fifth Circuit, which also was cited in the government's brief. Those cases dealt with expert testimony by, for example, IRS agents or other government experts testifying about whether it's loan schemes or fraud schemes in the context of 704.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been addressed in the Seventh Circuit as well as other circuits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in addition to Mr. Mouth's testimony about the lack of MLS data, there was also testimony by Mr. Mouth regarding the fact that the appraisal reports used completely improper comparables. The reports, the properties that were the subject property that were being appraised were being compared to properties in nicer neighborhoods, being compared to properties which, although the comparable properties should be host to houses that were recently sold in the general area, which would reflect the market value. Mr. Owens would actually go outside of that area to find nicer homes and to try to support his grossly inflated appraisal. The appraisal reports also didn't make any adjustments that would comply with industry standards regarding differences to account for differences between the subject property as well as the housing comparables that were supposed to support the appraisal. And really, in the end, the appraisals themselves, the gross amount of inflation between what the original asking price was on the initial sale or the listing MLS price versus what Mr. Owens had appraised it at, 200 to 300 times sometimes more than what the housing asking price was. And so in the end,
300 times?
200 to 300 times, or 2 to 3 times. Yeah, greater.
It's a lot different than 200 to 300 times.
Yes, 2 to 3 times greater, yeah.
On you have them in your exhibit here, where you talk about the MLS asking price. Is that, then you also talk about the sale price, which I presume is what's his name?
Brian Parr.
The ringleader, yeah, he paid. And obviously that price wasn't on there, but you're saying even on the appraisals, the MLS asking price did not appear either.
Did not appear on the appraisal, which is what the market is asking, and therefore the lending institution, because they wouldn't know this, Mr. Owens was able to get away with inflating the price on the second sale because it never reflected the MLS asking price.
If that is such a consistent ingredient in every appraisal, why would any lending institution?
I don't recall
when it is not.
I don't recall whether there's anything in the record that addressed Your Honor's specific question about why a banker or a particular lender didn't.
Well, it is pretty baffling when you look at the statistics of why they loan that much money for what obviously is a house worth much less. It just go and look at it.
And that's why the appraisal was so important. I mean, the lending institution is depending upon the appraiser to provide a good faith appraisal. And in fact, there was testimony at trial regarding the appraisals in which Mr. Owens signed off on these various affirmations regarding his good faith in performing the appraisal, which was then submitted to the lending institution, about how he complied with industry standards and that he didn't have any interest or any, there was no third-party influence. That goes directly to, I think, the issue, Your Honor, which is the lending institutions depend upon the appraisal to be honest and in good faith. And so when Mr. Mialto testified regarding that the appraisal for misleading and fraud, he was only stating the obvious, and it was a natural conclusion, an inevitable conclusion, based upon the testimony of the basis of his opinion. And beyond that, when you look at that testimony in the scope of the entire trial and the other evidence that showed the fraudulent nature of the appraisal, it becomes clear that testimony certainly had no impact on the outcome of the trial. The testimony by the co-schemers regarding Mr. Owens receiving amounts $500,000 above what his normal fees were, which were not reflected in the rest of the closing documents. Testimony by Tamir Smith and Brian Parr regarding the amounts in which he would there would be conversations with Mr. Owens, where Mr. Owens would say, "Well, I don't know if I can get that value." And okay, how about this? X amount of money. Okay, well now you can get the value. So there was abundant of evidence, as well as the admission to the FBI agent regarding Mr. Owens' belief that Mr. Parr was involved in these flip transactions. All this evidence, Your Honor, shows that Mr. Owens was an integral player, and in fact, Mr. Owens' role in all this was crucial, because if he doesn't provide the false inflated appraisals, nobody in the scheme gets paid. The crooked attorney who went to trial with him doesn't get paid. Mr. Parr doesn't get paid. Nobody gets paid without the inflated appraisal that Mr. Owens provided. And for that basis, the government would ask the court affirm Mr. Owens' conviction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Parr?
Yes, briefly, the expert was asked by me on a number of occasions, specifically, show me in your guidelines and your rules where you must put down the MLS for a bank to do a loan. And he said, "Well, I can't show you that. I'm just telling you the way we usually do it." We did not bring up the bank's situation with respect to these loans during the trial, for a variety of tactical and strategic reasons. But suffice it to say, these banks knew that the government was insuring these loans, and frankly, they knew they were going to get their money back one way or the other, I would assume. Since they knew that, had it been a private individual going in without a HUD loan and getting a loan and submitting an appraisal, there might have been a great deal more scrutiny by the bank. But that was very difficult to approach a jury with an argument like that. With respect to Mr. Owens, it didn't help him at all. That's why it was baffling on the record, because all of these things mentioned by the government really didn't matter to the banks, because they had another reason to give the loans out. And that's why I think the fact that the expert is allowed to say that this man's illegitimate, or by implication he's illegitimate, because no legitimate appraiser could come to that conclusion, that they overstepped 704B and should have reduced the verdict. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clark, and we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case, the assistance you've been to your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.